Here's another Daybreak Dose with your hosts, Dan Buffa and Matt Whitener, on the all-new 590 The Fan, 105.7 HD2 FM, and InsideSTL.com.
That's basically a little Black Keys. I can notice Dan Auerbach's guitar from a little bit of a brief listen here on the Southwest Diner Daybreak Dose. It's Black Keys, man. We bring you into the show at Black Keys. We usually bring you into one of the 6 or 6:30 segments with a little Black Keys. You can listen to them. We just let that play for a few minutes if we had the time. But we don't have the time. We are joined by Corey, showrunner, executive producer, director of the Cinemax breakout series of 2016. He brought you Banshee. He gave you samples of Ray Donovan and even back in the day, Fox's House. It is Greg Yatanis. I mean, I'll tell you what, folks, tonight at 9 p.m. is the finale of this show. It's so good that, I mean, you have to get a chance to watch it.
I watched this last episode twice because I think it was one of the strongest episodes. It's number 7.
Oh, thank you. Are you like 7 a lot? Oh, that's good.
Yeah, but really, you know, getting into this, you know, the setting of Quarry is Memphis in 1972. It's a hotly contested era for the United States with a disillusioned Vietnam War. However, not a lot has changed really. If you flash forward 44 years. Our world is still kind of a torn one. There's some parallels there. Did that go into this show's conception, the way that the climate of the world is kind of the same in 72 and 2016?
Yeah, the guys definitely. I mean, it was originally written for 71, and when we got the green light, we adjusted the scripts into 72. And the guys were extremely steeped in the research for this. So, I don't think it was something we were necessarily thinking about when we were actually making it, but as Quarry wrapped and was in the can and the decision when to put it on, the fact that it was so closely mirroring a polarizing election with polarizing race issues, with polarizing war in the backdrop, it was obvious and not by accident when we released it.
Yeah, definitely. And really, the racial tensions in the era, you don't skip over them in the show. It must have been crazy shooting that bus scene with the kids, because that's a lot of tension in that scene, and that kind of really describes the series. You guys never really skip away from the tensions in that era.
No, I mean, it was what was happening, and it's sadly, having spent time, I don't think it represents all of the South, but I've been working in the South for 5 years, and sadly it's just gotten a little more buried, but it's still prevalent. As an outsider, I could feel it. So and in talking to people that were around in 1972 Memphis, that was an air of issue. It was in the wake of the King assassination, the city had a cloud hanging over it, and these tensions and the spirit of the city had been broken, and we were 3 years outside of that. The music was dying, the culture and the spirit, the joy of the city was being crippled, not dissimilar to what Dallas experienced with JFK. It's like that's something that hung over that city for a long time, and the King assassination was no different. And so those racial tensions, once a hub of unity because of the music and how it brought people together, especially at the Lorraine Motel, and here we are examining it. So, Marcus and the connective tissue is that everybody is experiencing a form of post-traumatic stress. Marcus will deal with what he saw on that bus. Joni will deal with what happened to her with Suggs. Mac is obviously dealing with something that, we find out the answer to in the finale.
Yeah, definitely. And really, there's similarities between Lucas Hood and Mac Conway, two men torn by war but also by their general accountability. As the season has worn on, it seems like there are two personalities in Conway fighting over his soul. The one that wants to live a normal life, and then the one that is spiraling out of control into darkness. Will fans get to see which part wins this Friday, or is it kind of one of those things that may never be decided?
I think I don't see it as two sides and one winning. I see it as two sides that become integrated and learn to accept the other's shadow self. So that's basically, I feel, is where the journey of the season is going. And there's a scene that we're putting up this week that we took out of the finale, but I wrote a Medium article about it, which was the original opening to the finale episode, which goes back and is a flashback a year before the pilot starts, when Matt goes to war for the second time. And when you see it, you really see how far and how much Mac's integration has come across the season at this point after seven episodes.
Yeah, it's one of the, and it's the interesting thing about the show is that you never really forget about any of the other cast. There may be a lead guy, but there's also, the cast is so varied and so powerful and so versatile. One of the treasures of this show is Damon Herriman, who has brought a sincere vulnerability to Buddy, a killer who's starting to accumulate too many miles on his conscience to move forward, yet he can't break away from the life that he's put himself in either. That's just one of those roles that kind of sneaks up out of nowhere and just takes a hold of the viewer.
Well, I throw all this back onto Alexa Fogel, who cast Banshee and cast Quarry, and she cast The Wire and Oz and True Detective and NYPD Blue. I mean, she's, I gravitate to like leading men ensembles, between Banshee and Quarry and House. You know, I feel like the supporting cast is what that lead plays off of. So these ensembles fascinate me. And finding Buddy was very difficult. You know, we didn't see a lot of people. Damon came in early in the process, and like, it was clear. And what's always fascinated me about Buddy is that he is the only character leading a triple life. You know, Mac is leading a double life of a husband turned hitman. Buddy is going a step further. He's leading a closeted life of, you know, a homosexual man in 1972, the South. And we see, you know, very accurately, you know, where other gay men had to go to connect with each other. And it's really quite sad, the state of that had to happen and be viewed as something that was deviant and pushed out to the outer abandoned warehouses of Memphis. But we shine a light on that, as you'll see in the finale.
Yeah, and really that's an example of how we talked about earlier with the parallels between back then and today. As you know, it's gays, there's a lot of homosexuals that have to kind of still have to cover up and do things in the shadows and not really fully come out. And that's something that a lot of people can connect with Buddy's character.
Yeah, I mean, the politics, sadly, you know, especially regionally, have not caught up to other parts of the country, and that is and remains disappointing and sad to me.
Yeah. So how has it been working with a talented duo like Michael D. Fuller and Graham Gordy on this great Max Allen Collins source material? I mean, this is like a home run as far as a writing, directing, and source material team. This is just, it's one of those juicy combos.
There is phenomenal talent going on, especially in the writing, you know, department of the show. This is a similar, you know, Cinemax, you know, hired me in a similar capacity as I did in Banshee, which was that Jonathan Tropper at the time wasn't produced, and I was brought in as showrunner. Jonathan had the writing under control. I was there to shepherd it, guide them through the process, and build the world. And it was a very similar situation, with Graham and Michael. I mean, with that comes enormous creativity and discussions. It also is difficult being the last one in to a project and, you know, being the CEO of someone else's company. So, and I always treat that with as much respect and understanding that, you know, I'm here to get this across the finish line and guide them to success, because I know the company, I know the process. You know, I've produced, you know, over 200 hours of television. So I use that experience to help get them there. But it's, Quarry, because of its scope and its logistics, was enormously challenging. And, you know, we shot it a year ago and now we're finally airing. So with that, I feel that, you know, we're very, very happy that it's come together. And, the guys and I haven't worked together in well over a year. So it's, but it's a period of time in my career that I look back fondly on.
And really, you know, one of the things I always find myself explaining to people is what is the actual, what goes on with the job of a showrunner as opposed to all the other separate things. Because I've always kind of found myself explaining to people, and I think I do a good enough job, but I think enlightening everybody would be something that could help them out as far as what a showrunner does for a television show.
I mean, the easy answer is that I'm the final yes and no on, you know, whether it was Banshee or Corey. You know, the scope of the work, traditionally, I occupy an untraditional position in that role that usually is dedicated to the writer creator of the show. But, you know, as TV has grown in scope, you know, sometimes great writers don't come with great management. And, you know, it is a role of tremendous management. You are managing a company, a startup that has 200 employees out of the gate. So it's, there is an enormous amount of just managing the company, managing people's expectations, staying on, just like any business, staying on track, not getting yourself into trouble financially, making sure that you're delivering the goods every day. And that person, you know, and I do a lot of interfacing with the network. And if there is a studio, you know, that's, you know, Lionsgate is the studio on Manifesto, my Unabomber project. And I'm occupying a similar role. Andrew's a phenomenally talented writer who clearly gets it, but they just feel comfortable having, you know, someone with some experience helping him through the process and dividing up some of the work. So with Graham and Michael, it was similar. I would consult, but ultimately, you know, had to make sometimes difficult creative decisions on behalf of the greater good that we needed to deliver these episodes. And so I'm often seeing the forest for everybody from 30,000 feet.
Essentially. And really, you know, television is kind of overpowering film at the moment. It's a big movement, as you said. Part of what wave of shows are led by anti-heroes. Do you find these kind of shows with reluctant or dangerous leading characters more interesting? It's people like Tony Soprano, Lucas Hood, Walter White, and now Matt Conway. Those are the kind of shows that seem to be dominating the television airwaves.
They are. I feel like, though, the next wave of things will move away. I think we'll move away from that for a while. Like, I can sense that we'll move away from the traditional anti-hero model. You know, I feel like we're just in terms of a trend in television or movement in television, it feels as though to me that we're moving away from that at the moment. So, you know, that may not be apparent what's on television right now, but I would say, you know, within a year's time, you're going to see, you know, more, you know, bigger ideas, more conceptual shows, less of the less Tony Sopranos and Don Drapers and of the world.
Yeah, and really, one of the things you do in addition to being a showrunner is that you are really a very gifted director. I mean, you utilize camera angles and any prop in the shot, such as this past week where you utilized the mirror in the scene with the broker and Joni. And it's a lot of stylized shots, but everything has a meaning. You don't waste a single shot. What's the thought process whenever you go on to a set getting ready to direct any scene? Are you already thinking about everything in the room, or is it just a certain idea or concept?
You know, I pivot the needs of the project. You know, Banshee had very different needs than what Corey needed. You know, and I designed, you know, with Pepe, my DP, designed a visual style that I could accomplish in the schedule. You know, I had no less work in a day of Quarry than I did on a day of Banshee or a day of House. There was, you know, we were still doing 7, 8, 9, 10 pages a day on Quarry. But I designed a visual style where every shot meant something. You know, it was I worked from the acting and the writing outward so that the shots and the design were all motivated by the staging of the actors, what felt right. I tried to be very careful not to force, you know, have things feel forced or feel stagey in the case of Quarry. So, you know, and in terms of in more actionable terms, that meant staying away from traditional masters, over the shoulders, close-ups. You know, I get very impatient with television when there's a sameness, when, you know, it's like, okay, it just becomes predict, the cutting becomes predictable, the pattern of shooting becomes predictable. And often that's just because you have to. You're threading these very fine needles on a 42-minute hour of network television. and you have to have those options because you have to manipulate the you know, the running time. You know, we didn't have any limits on that, so I was able to embrace a more cinematic style and could let scenes play out and let the psychological drama burn and play the thriller elements. And for me, like, Quarry's the closest thing to a real film experience that I've had. I shot, you know, 85 consecutive days, and, you know, had a visual style that I felt moved away from a lot of the visual tropes that television has.
Yeah, well, one thing you really do with this show is you really, like, whip the tarp off of an actor like Logan Marshall Green, who has just really taken over this role. He's kind of the heart and soul of the show. How is it to kind of find an actor that we all can know and see, but then give them this new role that really explores the depths of their talent?
You know, it's funny because Alexa told me in hindsight that that Logan had read for Lucas Hood at one time. And, you know, and it shows how, like, when the right role and the right actor connect, like, it's just, it happens. It's undeniable. And I think that's the case with Logan and Mac. And Logan takes his work and his craft and his dedication to that, you know, extremely, you know, takes it very seriously. And he's made the role his own. You know, he was with the project before I came on. So, you know, that negotiation and conversation in the very beginning was an interesting one because it was the first time I was coming to a project where there was already a lead actor in place.
So I guess all the fans are kind of waiting as we approach the finale. Is there any news on a season two pickup? Is there any traction towards that from Cinemax, or is it going to be a one and done? Or
We don't know right now. I think Cinemax, you know, is having, you know, worked there now 5 years. It's a very, you know, they care for the HBO Cinemax culture, you know, curates and makes decisions appropriately to, you know, evaluating the whole project. There's a lot of things that go into what makes something a success in pay TV. The ratings are just simply one component of that. So, you know, they're once it's all done, they'll look at the project holistically when all the data is in and make a decision on that. But certainly the fan response has been positive and the critical response has been thrilling. So, you know, we're always optimistic.
Now there is, you know, there is something going on with Microcosm Blues, your next Cinemax series. And for me, Greg, this is like getting the band back together. It's Cinemax, it's you and it's Tropper, and you guys are doing this thing, so this gets me excited. And you also pull in an actor like Patrick Dempsey. Is there any details about this series that can be released, or is it still kind of in the pre-production phase?
Yeah, Micronesian Blues is a, you know, is kind of a return to form for Cinemax, to the Banshee years, I feel, and reinventing, you know, Patrick's persona from network television into pay TV, I feel like is going to be exciting. I've seen the first draft of the script from Tropper, and where it's going is fantastic. And it's inspired by a real story, but not limited by the fact that it's a real story and really opens up into a world we've never seen in television.
Definitely. So really, if you can tease this final finale, like what should fans expect? I mean, when we see a big shootout with a merry-go-round, I mean, what should fans, are we just going to be blown away? I mean, is there going to be like a cliffhanger is what I'm trying to get at? Or is it going to be like a tied-up storyline where season two could possibly go in another direction? Or is it going to leave some threads hanging? Or what can fans expect on Friday night?
I think fans can expect that they'll get anybody that's been with the show since the pilot will get an answer to not only what the opening of the pilot was about, but also what happened in Kwantung. You know, episode 8 goes to Vietnam. And in terms of, you know, coming in for a satisfying, fully emotionally closed finale, they're going to get that. You know, as always with life, you know, life is going to go on. But every thread, every question, everything will wrap itself up in a very satisfying way. I'm thrilled that the finale has turned out as well as it has. Episode 8 and episode 4 are the more meaningful episodes for me personally, directorially, and are my the ones I have extra affection for. I love all my children, but I love these two are very those two episodes are very special for me.
So now 4 was the hotel. Am I guessing right?
Yes, you're correct.
Man, that I'll tell you. I mean, and let me just—I know we're going over our time here, but I mean, but that was just one setting. I mean, that reminded me of so many movies that I probably can't even list them. Of just this that setting, they use one setting, and all this happens, and all this thing builds up, and yet what happens is not what you expect. It just it's one of those things where. I can see what you said with the cinematic television, how it's really, you know, you're combining the great parts of cinema with the great parts of television to where it feels like a mini movie every Friday night.
Okay. That's the idea. Episode 4, you know, it was actually inspired by episode 7 of season 1 of Banshee. You know, we needed to do what's called a bottle show, where you contain an episode to a single location. And, just felt for us, you know, where we were organically in the story, discussed with the guys, and we came up with the idea that they had, you know, retreated to this motel and we would have this reckoning of scenes. The episode used to be more sprawling and we, you know, contained it. There is a companion piece on YouTube of what Carl was doing during the events of episode 4 for those Carl fans that want to deeper dive. But it was... you know, containing that space. And it always inevitably turns out to be an interesting episode because it forces you into having to face the characters head on and face, you know, the writing and the acting head on. And I couldn't have had two better actors to have centered that around than Logan and Jody.
Definitely not, man. And that's what you're doing. See, and I'm proud to be the one of the guys that really got in at the birth of this Banshee thing with Cinemax. You guys are really turning Cinemax into a heavyweight. Because you create these things that are not like, maybe the awards don't, well, these kind of shows don't need awards, let's put it that way. That they kind of, they grip viewers.
Oh, some awards would be nice to recognize the craft of the work. But you've been like, you know, a great, or you're one of the really earliest adopters of Banshee and really, you know, grabbed on to what Cinemax was doing. So it's always a pleasure getting to talk to you.
Heck yeah, Greg. Well, I'll be heavily awaiting the tomorrow's finale, and I'll be waiting the next series, man. This has been a great another great show, and I hope it gets another season, and I hope we get to see some more Matt Conway adventures, because it's almost like another world where maybe Banshee existed somewhere else, but now we get Matt Conway's world. So fans are loving it. I'm loving it. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today, Greg. You have a good day.
Damn, man, thank you. I appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you.
All right, man. Have a good day.
All right. See you. Bye.
That was Greg Yatanis, showrunner, executive producer, and director of Cinemax's Quarry, which is wrapping up its first season on Cinemax Friday night at 9 p.m. Central Time. He's also the guy behind Banshee. He is going to be doing Micronesian Blues with Patrick Dempsey on Cinemax. He has done some episodes of House and Ray Donovan. He has done a little bit of this and a little bit of that. One of the guys in television that really is changing the landscape and combining cinematic features with television. So that was a great time talking to Greg. We're going to get him on in the future when we get more details about his next projects. But give Quarry a shot, and we'll be right back on the Southwest Diner Daybreak Dose, going from an exclusive interview into another avenue, as we always do here on Inside STL, 590 The Fan, KFNS.